That was from Judges 5, verse 3. Hello, everyone, and my name is Janelle, as Phil said. Today I'm going to be presenting from a book chapter. It's a chapter in a book that I have written along with Professor Margaret Barrett from the University of Queensland on this topic. So I'm not going to lecture you on this. You can search for it just online. For the chapter in your from your libraries online, that sort of thing. You can get a copy of the slides as well. So I'm going to briefly talk to you about what this study was about, what some of the key findings were as well, and that's where I really want to progress to. So I'm going to jump through these slides and really focus on the findings for this. So as you can see here, this is the book, and you can get it on JSTOR. If you can just you can have a look online to be able to access that as well. So essentially, we know that identity in young adolescents or teenagers right up until about 18 years old can be very fluid. We know that identity is a very multifaceted aspect and it's something that students struggle with a lot. So this study actually came about in a adolescent identity formation research looking at how students in Catholic schools have using music as a way to sort of re-support their own religious identity and how they can use music to help their spiritual understanding and sort of make sense with all these sort of different facets that are happening around their world. So the study took place in a Catholic or girls' school. There was actually a really large Muslim population in this school, which was quite interesting. So the diversity in the school in terms of nationalities, ethnicities, even religious backgrounds was really diverse in this particular Catholic school. The study was a qualitative interpretive study and again looks at how religion impacts identity, and then we're going to focus a bit more about music. So a lot of the research talks about music and identity work. Identity work is so crucial in terms of how adolescents progress through over the years, from about 12 years old through to about 18 years old, and music plays a crucial part in that. Students use music and listening to music, the lyrics, whether they can relate to music. They use it as a form of expression. They use it as a form of collective identity, where they want to fit in with one another. The way that they dress might reflect the way in which their band members or people that they look up to. They also use it even in social media. They'll put verses up or quotes from different aspects of their favourite song. So music actually plays a huge part of their identity. And it's very rare to see a teenager without music for majority of their time. When they're on the bus, when they're in the car, when they're walking around, doing exercise, when they're getting ready to go out to a party, they're going to have music, and that's because they use it to influence their identity, but they also use it as a way of expressing their identity. So in Australia, we have the Catholic education system, which is actually the largest out of the private systems. We then have the state system, so state and private, Catholic being the largest proportion of all of these. And it's really interesting, the research has been showing that the number of Catholic-affiliated students in Catholic schools is definitely declining. So there is a real big research gap between the demographics, the changing times and nature of students and schools, their identity work of the adolescents, and the way in which we could use music in Catholic schools and the traditions that are there to actually go back and try and help students to come back, find their religious identity, find their spirituality and engage with that again, and rather than sort of put it on a shelf. So this is sort of a broad overview of how I'm sort of looked at the research, is that we have music in schools, we have music outside of schools, we've got their school experience and their religious experience. There was actually a lot of research missing about the connection between all three. So a lot of the research looked at religious identity with schools, it looked at music and identity, or it looked at their school experience with identity work. But there was a lot of research missing about the impact in which religious music in a school setting impacted their identity work. And considering they spend so much time in their schooling years and all of their identity formation, a huge part of it, would actually take place at school, it's really impertinent that the research then and that this research gap could take place in order to explore and make connections. So the methodology that I used was, as I mentioned earlier, qualitative. I did observation and interviews, and then I did a narrative analysis to understand the students' stories. I wanted them to tell me about their experiences. I wanted to understand it from their perspectives, what it meant to them. So I started to build a relationship with them, interviewed them over a number of period of times in order to come up with some data and some common themes that actually emerged all the way through it. The school, this particular school that I researched, was in the metropolitan area. It was a Chevalier Values school and very inclusive of all nationalities. And the participants in particular were year 12, so in the final year of schooling. So they experienced schooling for year 8, year 7, year 8, right up all the way through. So their identity formation was starting to sort of get to that point where they're making sense of it all as well. So there's three key themes that have come out, and I'm going to talk to you about that today, with how religious music, their experiences with religious music in their Catholic school impacted them. So keep in mind that some of these students that were interviewed and observed, they were not religious, but they were in a Catholic school. They might have been Muslim or of another faith, and there was also Catholics or of another Christian denomination. So there was a real mix in the Catholic school, and considering the ongoing research that talks about the decrease of religious identity, spirituality and Catholicism in students' beliefs, I've got some really interesting findings that have come out of this. So in the Dr. Phil style, we're actually going to do something a little bit more interactive now. You can work in groups if you like. So I'll get an exit out of that, please. Thank you. I'm just going to jump over here. And we're going to play a Kahoot. If you don't know what that is, that's okay. Just join with someone. Or if you get your smart device, get a smart device and go to Kahoot.it, www.kahoot.it, or you can just scan that. If you just hold your photo up, like your phone up, and scan it. If you would like to join with someone else, I'm sure we can all share as well if you don't know how to do that. Make up your own name. It doesn't have to be your real name. If anyone needs help, just give me a nod, and I can do that now. Yeah? You can just hold your photo up and it should go to a link. You can just join someone else if it's easier. Yeah, you just join. There we go. Yep, great. I think I've only got 10 on there anyway. So we've got Ben, Major, Tash, Qua. Waiting for a few more people to join. If not, just join with someone else if you would like. No, just Kahoot.it. You're doing it as well, Phil.
Yeah.
So I'll still get you to press my slides, please, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
Cool. Sorry. So I've decided to use this to present my findings rather than just talk to you about it. I thought, let's see if you can also figure out what some of these findings were as we go through it. So how Kahoot works, if you're not sure, is it's like a quiz. So you don't know my participants. I've only gave you a little bit of an insight. Keep in mind, this is the perspectives and opinions of these particular students. It's not necessarily what you would think, what you agree with, or what I agree with. This is solely their opinions and research that's come through, and I've kept that true to what they've explained to me about their experiences in this particular school. So that's what's going to happen there. So it'll be a quiz. You just click on the button, whichever one you think is the correct answer. There is a time limit, so you're going to be pretty quick. You'll see the time limit up. And here we go. All right, I'll get you to start, please. Thank you. All right, so we're going to talk about some of the key findings. Here we go. I probably need to give you a bit of context of these too. So which of the following do you think participants identified as the most influential to their identity? Their religious and spiritual identity. Was it sermons at mass or assembly, religious music at assemblies and mass, religion education classes, or contemporary stories or spoken word? So you just click on the colour or on the picture. We've got 8 answers, a couple more people. Alrighty. So, interesting. So, seven of you thought that adolescents see that contemporary stories and spoken words in their classroom experiences or within their school experience had the biggest influence on their religious and spiritual identity. But, in fact, it was religious music at assemblies and mass. So, some of the research that came through with it is that it was inspirational because adolescents felt that it was fostering a deeper sense of spiritual and religious connection with them, that music, if chosen appropriately, it really does foster them to think more deeply, to connect with God more, and to sort of zone out and think about spirituality and the meaning of the lyrics to them. Was actually some of the findings that came through it. It seems to be that music was a way that makes them really think deeply and more spiritually as opposed to being lectured or a sermon or a spoken word, which is really quite interesting. So we'll go on to the next one. What have these students preferred in the participants? Was it contemporary Christian hymns, music without lyrics, secular music with personal interpretation, or traditional Christian music? So in this particular study, the students were asked about it. So if you want to quickly pick your answer. It doesn't matter if you get it wrong because you don't know my participants. It was just an interactive way to get you thinking about what the answers might have been. Alrighty. So only one person got this right. Well done to the winner. Was that Phil? Well done, Phil.
I picked up the clue from the last one.
Yeah. So traditional music, such as Catholic hymns, and was actually preferred over music popular choice over popular Christian music was actually preferred. And this was actually because it was tied to liturgical action and reinforced the message of the service. So the students said, in contrast to secular music, spiritual music, religious music was a way that adolescents of all faiths could connect to the music, draw their own personal experience from it as well. And the use of music is illustrated in a variety of different ways. I might just read you one of the students. She said, this is Kate. Kate said, I think music kind of gives, and this is religious traditional music, I think music kind of gives the way of connecting with things. So even in church, like everyone at school would just be so bored if it was talk, 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 talk. And the fact that we've got music in between gives us a break and gives us something to be more relatable. And Jasmine says, it can give you others' views on religion too. And Kate also goes on to explain how learning about, and she wasn't actually religious per se, but she said learning about others and seeing her peers interact with the religious music made her stop and think and start reflecting about the lyrics and what it meant and seeing other people sing as well. She actually goes on and talks about that, which is some interesting findings there. So the next one. I asked participants, what should be changed with the liturgical music or religious music at their school? Did they say, get rid of old hymns? Do they want more secular music? Nothing should be changed or include more instrumental music. So if you'd like to quickly pick an answer, quick as you can. Cool. All right. So we have five people that got that correct. Then when I asked the students, they actually nearly all of them said they did not want anything changed at all. So some interesting findings were Han. Han said, I like it the way it is. And she goes on to say how sacred music is more meaningful to them. It's a time of peace in sacred music. And it was a time to reflect on what religion is, why they're all together and why they're actually doing that task. So Anne was an interesting student because she actually talked about her own confusion with religious identity as well. So we'll go on to the next question, and this will sort of give some insight into what Anne thinks. She's confused with her own religious identity. What has helped her? Was it the music at her school, the prayer at her school, the friendships at her school, or her church experience? Quick as you can, just pick a colour. Great. So it was, in fact, music. So This was because she says that she relies on music to support her faith, and she states that it's like being open-minded. She says, yeah, I'm still confused with my faith. I just depend on music. Like, I've got my faith in that. And when I asked her to describe her faith in music and what that actually means, she stated, it's just a constant thing that's always going to be there. It's helped me through the hard times, so it's going to keep. I'm going to keep depending on the music to get me through. And I hope you know that I'll always have faith in music. So the liturgical music also helps Lisa to become more reflective about the messages of the Mass and her relationship to God. So when this, what a lot of the findings were about is when the students were listening to sermons, they actually really struggled to connect or to not zone out when there was talking. But it was when they had the music, the lyrics actually did a lot for them. And they started thinking about the lyrics, and they looked like they're daydreaming, or some of them were singing and some of them were just sitting there. But there was a lot of identity work actually going on, which was quite fascinating. So the next one, pop song. Secular pop song was played at retreat this year. This is their religious retreat. How do you think the students responded? It was great to have a secular song. They were totally confused. They enjoyed some familiarity, or it's fine as long as there are religious songs as well. So they were totally confused. And this was really interesting because I expected them to have some of these other answers as well. But the students were actually saying things like, even though they weren't religious, or some of them had different religious experiences and backgrounds, they said they wanted and expected and liked traditional religious music at their retreats. So Nee said, at retreat this year, we went into prayer and two girls started singing Marry You by Bruno Mars, and I was so confused. And then another girl responds saying, yeah, it was totally unrelated. Nee continues, and when they finished, we were just all like, what was that? What just happened? It's not related to religion at all, particularly in liturgical music. So they go on to explain how they prefer the traditional Catholic music because it's what they're familiar with, what they expect it to. And if you think about their life worlds is so chaotic. There are so many changes. They don't know what they're going to expect. They don't know what their home life is going to be like when they get home. They could have friendship issues at school, don't know what's happening with assignments and teachers. But traditional religious music was something that was a stock standard thing they expected. They knew what the hymns were. They knew the songs. They just churned through them. And it was a way they could just sit and feel comfortable. It was an expectation. They knew what was happening. And for them, they knew, I hear that music. It means sacred time. So they actually felt like, regardless of their beliefs, that's what had happened. We're almost there. The participants identified how certain religious songs are important at school because it fosters institutionalised Catholic identity, it helps to share a common understanding of rituals, it enables a common identity and belonging, or all of the above. Just a couple more people, I think, need to pick a colour. So it was all of the above. Students said it actually created a sense of belonging. They felt like they belonged to something. So a part of identity work with adolescents in that particular age range is that they need to feel like they belong. That's so important to them. And when they're actually in a church setting and they're feeling sort of not a church setting per se, but in a school setting where they've got a Mass taking place, they're all together, they're all singing, they've all got a common sense of belonging. They're all singing the same songs and they're all doing it together. It gave them a sense of that's what it meant to be part of that school. It was, it helped them to realise that they're all the same. They're all the same people. They're all experiencing the same thing. It was a sense of commonality. And it also was, some of the students also said how it brought them all together, regardless of their religious backgrounds, beliefs, if they had a fight with someone, if they weren't sure what was going on with this, that and the other. It was a way that they could all connect and be together. And last question. Religious music at school fosters positivity and enjoyment and negative peer pressure to not sing. Those are the faiths to further connect, or the importance of tradition. So it was actually positivity and enjoyment. The students actually really enjoyed the experience, even though sometimes it doesn't seem like they have. all of them, and these are year 12, so they've done most of their schooling, they actually report back saying, yeah, we actually like it. We like the tradition. We like the religious music. And in particular, they had this favourite song, which isn't actually a Catholic song. It's a more of a generic Christian song, which was Shine, Jesus, Shine, if you know that one. And they had these, like, actions that they would do, and that when that song came up, it was almost like a school anthem. When that song came up, they're all doing these actions and singing, a whole mass of girls doing it. And it was really beautiful to see because they all did it. There was the Muslim girls with their headscarves doing it. You got some of the girls I'd interviewed said, no, I'm not into religion. And they're all doing it, all participating, all having fun, and they felt like they belonged. And it was a really positive and religious music for them, helped them to connect religion and spirituality to a really positive experience amongst all of them. It gave them a sense of collective identity. So let's see who the winners are here. Not that it really matters. But that sort of brings me to the end of my presentation today. As I said, it was just a brief insight into I had so many amazing findings. I did a case study with a girls' school, a boys' school, and a mixed school as well. And I then compared all the three schools as well independently to all of those. This the chapter in here is based on the girls' school. Or if you just Google my name, you'll be able to find other articles that look at some other research that I've done in this field. But I do encourage you all to not get rid of tradition as well, not get rid of traditional elements in schools, in music. And if anything, ask adolescents. Ask them what they want. We shouldn't assume that we know what is good for them. It's always important when it comes to religion and identity work is we speak to them and we find out firsthand what's important to them. Thank you.
Thank
you, Janelle. You're
welcome. Yes. There will be an opportunity after the final presentation for questions and comments and reflections. But I really appreciate the insight you've brought to us in our presentation today. So, Audrey's getting set up for their presentation. So, continuing the theme of spirituality and how we work with
yeah.
Australian schools.
Is that my timer? Perfect.
No, that's my timer.
Oh, that was for me. I thought it was good timing.
Perfect.
Yeah? All good?
It's not working.
The clicker?
Yeah.
Is that your clicker?
Yeah, can you do it?
Yeah, it's in.
Just want to start off with an apology in that I actually didn't get my conference paper in until 9 a.m. this morning. I sent it to you, Phil, so it's not up yet, but hopefully it will be up so that you can have a read, and what I'm talking about, if you're interested in it, you can have a look later. A little bit about myself. I'm based in Melbourne, so I've made the trip here to Adelaide. I'm a casual lecturer at Deakin University in the School of Education. And I'm also working at YTU, which is part of the University of Divinity, giving professional development to Catholic teachers who have to do their GCRTE. Is that right? Their Graduate Certificate of Religious Education. So quick question, is there anyone here who's a teacher in a primary school, secondary school? Is it a faith school?
It is a faith school.
I'll be interested to know what you think. So my paper, it grew out of my PhD, which I completed a few years ago, which was on educating for democracy. Oh, hi. educating for democracy in Australian schools through an inquiry into the religious towards a secular age. So that's a bit of a mouthful. Looking back, probably should have curtailed it a bit. But my paper continues on that, but now it's bringing in my experience of working as a lecturer. Is that me making those noises?
No.
Cool. as a casual lecturer and tutor.
Maybe just bring it down.
Okay. I like to be near people, but anyway, that's why I'm standing back. So this is sort of a way of me working out for myself how I want to support the Catholic teachers who I'm taking the journey with. It's only 4 days that we have in semester one, but I'm also interested to know how I can create more democratic classrooms in my tutorials and in my lectures. So this is part of my own practice, really. So my thesis is kind of simple. It's that in a secular democracy like Australia, we ought to be in faith schools educating the spirituality of students and teachers to become more educated, to become better in the sense of more democratic, through fostering a democratic type of spirituality. And it's with that thesis, sort of you can break it down into three parts. Firstly, that secular does not mean anti-religion or exclusionary of the religious. That's the first claim. And then the second claim is that, linked to the first, in that secular can be experienced as exclusionary. But I would argue that that's because it's not democratic enough. So then the second claim is there's different kinds of democracy. There's a spectrum. And there's a minimal kind of democracy, and there's a kind of more comprehensive type of democracy. And they differ in the way that they're oriented towards plurality and values and education and spirituality. And so then that brings me to the third part of the thesis, which is that there is a type of democracy, a democratic spirituality, that is very hospitable and inclusive of difference and the other. And so then my argument is that is there a call for faith groups to implement, to foster democratic spirituality? And if you accept this thesis, and if you might not, and so you might reject any of those parts of the argument, but if you accept this thesis, then further questions arise, and I'll get to that in the second part, in the more interactive part. So how do I justify the fact that in common sense conversation, if you mention someone secular, you often understand that to be, I'm not religious, or I'm anti-religion, or that kind of thing. But I'm just bringing to your attention a Catholic philosopher called Charles Taylor. Have any of you come across Taylor's work? Righto, so you can correct me if I'm wrong. But Charles Taylor talks about how you can understand secularity in different ways. That's right. He talks about three different kinds of secularity. It could mean, firstly, that our public spaces have been emptied of God. And so you can probably think of examples like that, where you're walking past what used to be a church, it's now a cafe or a restaurant. Secondly, secularity could mean that our public spaces have been emptied. There's a falling off of religious practice and belief. And the census that was published last year would indicate that kind of secular. So there's this feeling of, an emptying out of people of faith. And I was really interested in your presentation, where in Catholic schools often it's such a diverse, multi-faith population, not just of students but of teachers as well. So that's the second kind of secularity. The third kind of secular, which Charles Taylor argues is the most important for a pluralistic society, is one where it represents the inclusion of being religious as one option amongst others. If you take Charles Taylor's point about the third kind of secularity, then you can argue that this calls for the state to inculcate, to provide opportunities for developing a democratic disposition, way of being, character on the part of all citizens, non-religious and religious together. And the idea being that that democratic disposition enables people to want to take part in deliberating about what the goals of the society ought to be in response to challenges that arise, and then commit to embodying them, courageously, one might say, embodying them in the face of obstacles. So, really interesting, different understandings of secular there. So, I think we need to dig a little bit deeper into what is meant by democracy and the democratic disposition. One source for thinking about different kinds of democracy is UNESCO, which published a few years ago now a report called Learning the Treasure Within, in which it urged governments of secular democracies to provide opportunities to educate citizens, and I'll make these slides available as well if you want them, to provide opportunities to educate citizens in a kind of democracy that is really, really inclusive and hospitable of difference, of different faiths and non-religious worldviews together, such that it's providing, fostering a democratic spirit that motivates differences to respectfully engage with each other in debate about public goods. And so I was really thinking about how relevant this would be for the sorts of schools that you were talking about, where we are just faith schools, yes, but the people that are attending them and working in them are of all sorts of different kinds of perspectives. And here's a quote, which I won't read out in its entirety, but it kind of gets at what UNESCO means by democratic spirit. And I mean, it goes, I guess what's at the heart of it is a kind of compassionate inclusivity and a willingness and a desire to engage with those who are very different from oneself in order to collaborate together to enact certain projects for the common good. So in UNESCO's Delors report, it talks about two pillars of learning, and so I'm talking now about education and what teachers are looking to do. So they're looking at developing the personhood of students, and that, according to UNESCO, is really, really important in order to get to the third pillar, or the fourth pillar, which is learning to live well with others. So that's where education comes in. It's fostering the personhood of students, which is holistic. It's to do with their values, their spirituality, their emotional intelligence, their physical components. And what's it for? It's the why. It's for learning to live well with others, especially those who are very different, at a time when the only constant thing is constant change. So getting to the third part of the thesis. And the question is, well, I would say that UNESCO, and this is what I argued in my PhD, that UNESCO's report is offering a challenge and an invitation to faith groups to implement or to take seriously this notion of democratic spirituality. And maybe that might be a bit off-putting, because that adjective of democratic in front of spirituality, people might have issues with that. But then the question is there an educational approach to democratic spirituality that is compatible with religious faith and is therefore appropriate for teaching in faith schools? What am I up to?
Ten.
Oh, sorry, guys, it goes so quickly. So just to wrap up, I argue that there is a kind of approach to democratic spirituality, one that's offered by John Dewey, which is appropriate for faith schools. So I'll turn now to participatory discussion. Well, actually, I'll stop there. Do you have questions? And are there any parts of that thesis that you disagree with? That's a good place to start. and a democratic question as well, I suppose.
Oh, I just have a question. Firstly, sure. Thank you so much. That was just so insightful, and I actually saw some commonality between my study and your study, even though they're very different. So I was just wondering, with the methodology that you use for this study, could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, so this was a qualitative study, but it's qualitative in the sense that it's drawing, I guess it was analysis of policy.
Okay.
And it was using, like, it's a philosophy of education kind of approach, which is what I did my PhD. So I didn't do interviews with people.
Right.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you.
There will be time for
questions.
Q&A at the end. For
okay, sorry.
At the end of the session.
Oh, goodo. All right. So for you guys, maybe thinking pairs, like think pair share. If you think this thesis has any validity, then the questions arise, and these are the questions for me. What kind of experiences, and especially for teachers, should teachers and leaders in faith schools offer to students? What would a lesson look like that fosters democratic spirituality? And then what kind of professional development should teachers in faith schools be offered? And then the last one is a question I'm asking myself. What kind of qualities and traits does an educator, a teacher educator, who's offering professional development for teachers in faith schools, who do I need to be? What kind of qualities and traits do I need to be aiming for and reflecting on and checking on in order to provide that support? So just for the next 10 minutes, I thought, pick a question and have a chat with each other, and I'd love to hear from you in like 5 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. No, there's almost 10 minutes, so you go for it. Just make sure you're getting with groups of three. Good, you know, Sydney can get a group of three going and have a conversation. We're running out of time to think people here.
Okay. Hi. It goes so quickly.
It does go quickly. 10 minutes is very short.
I might just grab my paper and show. What's your name?
I'm Natasha.
Natasha. Okay, awesome.
Hello.
Hi. I've got another question.
Yeah.
So then what's your perspective on tradition?
Yes. Tradition, don't get rid of it. Based on Dewey's notion of understanding of an appreciation of knowledge, he'd say he's not an out-and-out progressive who would say, oh, forget about tradition, forget about knowledge. It's all about the experience of the students. But Dewey would say we take knowledge, but we don't just accept it. We test it in response to context of students.
Yep.
So, sorry, is democratic spirituality, is that referring to the mode of how you engage students, like in a kind of, well, we want to draw out what you think and help you arrive at answers yourself and value different people's experiences? Or is it because the kind of complete, that's the kind of all-round development stuff, is spirituality what we're referring to as spirituality rather than specific democratic spirituality?
Right. Well, for me, yeah, so I didn't have time, but spirituality, according to Brendan Hyde, who writes in Catholic education literature, is something that we all have. It's a way of relating to oneself and the world. And so what I'm arguing for is to make that spirituality, which can often just be private, more democratic, such that one is more willing to engage with other people, especially those who are different, and think about shared projects that you can work on for the local community, going ever outwards.
Okay. So is it like this is how the teacher engages the students, or is it also kind of forming students spiritually to be good, like, democratic citizens, that one?
Yeah.
That's what UNESCO is calling for.
Yeah, I'd say so.
So it's a form of kind of civic education that's like has a spiritual, or is through the lens of spiritual formation?
It isn't so much civic, which would be kind of citizenship, although some people could call it citizenship. It is personal.
Yeah.
the way that Dewey inflects. So it's about character.
But it's for democracy?
Yeah, good questions. And this is because I didn't get to speak to the third bit. It's for democracy understood as a way of living,
right,
and a way of relating that's moral and ethical. Yeah.
I'd be interested to then take that claim and say, if schools engage in democratic spirituality, it would be nice to see the research to prove, hopefully, that it doesn't in fact diminish the religious identity of the school too. And I think there would actually be a really cool finding that would actually prove that it doesn't. And I think there's a lot of assumptions
cool.
by, you know, your old teachers and the old, you know, priests and all that go, oh no, you can't do that because it's going to diminish tradition, it's going to diminish religious identity altogether. I don't think it would. And this is something you would need to prove, but I don't think it actually would. I think it would be, in a way, it could actually be a way of celebrating and enriching existing Catholic traditions and identity that exists. But that would be a big one to prove.
That is such a good point.
Yeah. I think if you could prove that, I think then that would really stand.
I would need to at least address that objection.
Yeah, exactly.
Acknowledge it.
And that's like another, you know, that's like a postdoc. It's another, you know.
That's so true, though.
It would be interesting as well as there are a bunch of schools where the religious identity is a bit kind of contested.
True.
That the executive is not necessarily Christian or not all the staff.
Yeah.
And therefore, and even when, you know, it is very strongly Christian, they really have to, because they're on that, at that intersection point. And faith, they really have to show value add for parents who are like, well, I don't want my kid to be. I'm sending them to someone with a religious ethos, but I want to see that this matters even if they don't accept.
Yeah.
That, and this feels like
I do think that Dominican spirituality it has to happen, and I think if we don't, it's actually going to get rid of religion altogether if we don't start embracing democratic spirituality.
Mm.
And it's because it's just
in the face maybe of some parents' preconceptions about what religion is.
Well, in the wider community, there's sense that religious education is contributing to the Christian schooling or faith-based schooling. Forms people who are able to participate in productive ways to a pluralist society.
Yeah. God, I wish I was recording this. All of these points are so good.
Mm.
Yeah, that it's not just a bubble. Yeah.
And I mean, I have a good friend who has she's just moved schools actually for a few years. She's taught at a school which is like a very, like in theory a Christian school, but very kind of, like in some ways quite anti, like in an area that's very anti. It's a private school and it's kind of prestigious. So lots of rich kids who are like anti-religion, but the way that she has kind of like developed programs that really engage them, that go, that show how this matters for the things that they already care about, and invited them to kind of go, if this were true, what would that mean for XYZ? And therefore, even if they don't accept that it's true, they have a sense of, oh, well, these beliefs matter, like this way of life means something. Like, you can kind of see the difference in how they engage with claims of faith and people of faith, even if they're going to keep protecting it for themselves. I feel as though I wouldn't say would use that term, democratic spirituality, but I think it would fit.
And I think if the religious leaders as well and principals don't start getting on this bandwagon, I mean, it could be a real stopper, I think.
Yeah.
But if we engage with them, and if they actually help to develop this understanding of dramatic spirituality, it can be very healthy as well.
Yeah.
Mm.
What do you think a next step then is? I mean, because I'm thinking this through as part of my PhD, but...
Have you finished a PhD?
But I mean, excuse me. I'm thinking about this because I want to introduce it into my professional development for
Catholic teachers
in Catholic schools. But yeah.
Thanks for giving us an insight. We'd like to take the microphone off you.
That'd be great.
Oh,
yeah,
so
really,
if you've got time to ask people, sorry, I should have kept an eye on 5 minutes. But
no, it's all good. So we've had two excellent presentations. Janelle's been talking to us about the place of sacred music in Catholic schooling, and interestingly, the level at which students want to engage with the tradition. And the next, Audrey, our next speaker, was talking about the importance of democracy in spiritual education and faith-based schools. And Janelle's point was, don't assume for young people what they engage with and what they don't. Actually talk to them and ask them, so that there's a real correlation between the two presentations we've had so far. There will be time at the end of Stuart's presentation for us to have a bit of a Q&A around engaging with any of the three speakers there, even though I know that you've moved around and so on, you might not have been here for all of it. But Stu Devenish is a good friend and colleague, and he's going to come and talk to us about a school for the soul. Is that right, Stu?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And so, thank
you.
You
put that on, I'll give you a signal when the 10 minutes is up, and I'll just bring it.
Thanks, Phil. Well, hi everyone. Thanks for booking into my session. So those of you who are rent a crowd, I'll pay you later. Thanks for being here. So I'm basically a faculty at Tabor. This is my 10th year or 9th and a half year. So I've been in the research and the sort of supervision and theology, missiology, spirituality space, and it's been a wonderful journey. The book, the title of this paper is Can the Classical Christian Spiritual Tradition Be a School for the Soul for Secular Mystics in the Post-Secular Age? It's a long sentence. The backstory... It's coming. The backstory is I presented two sort of prior papers in this topic at ANZATS and another college paper. There's also two book manuscripts working towards this. So what I really want to do is to just augment the paper I've submitted, which you can access in a couple of days' time. So Phil's got this and it's available. That paper is basically talking about the emergence of the post-secular age and the explosion of interest in all things spiritual. And I'm interested in the fact that the Christian Church has not done anything, at least from where I stand, to take advantage of the on the one hand, the seeming death of formal religion, on the other hand, the explosion of interest in all things spiritual. So what has the Church done in this regard, and how can we facilitate a school for the soul for the post-secular mystic? And if you want to disprove my thesis that there is such a thing as a post-secular mystic, the onus is on you to do so. I'm making the claim, as is in fact the conference, that there is in fact an enormous interest in the spiritual out there. So what I want to do is simply answer the question, two questions. The first is, can the classical Christian spiritual tradition be a school for the soul for secular mystics in the post-secular age? My answer, a resounding yes. The second flow-on question is, how? So how could we do this? And I basically run over the four key moves in the paper, but I don't develop it. Because I haven't yet got to that book manuscript. I'm mid leap. I'm finishing off one manuscript before I address the other. I basically want to give you four answers to how. The first is that there's four moves that the church has to facilitate in its own thinking, more so than in the culture, because I think there's, to some extent, there's more interest in the spiritual in the culture than there is in the church. So the first move is to move from Christian education to spiritual education. So for those of you involved in Christian education, I've got some bad news. It's not working. And whatever we used to have in the church in terms of catechism and Sunday school and youth group and so forth, it's basically all become defunct. Most of our churches, our denominations, do have a catechism, but it's in the cupboard and it's locked because it's from three decades ago. It's no longer relevant. It's not working. And if you want to argue to the contrary, then God bless you. But in terms of a large-scale, faith-producing, disciple-producing Christian education program that doesn't just produce moral therapeutic deists, Christian Smith, then I'd like to meet your program. I think there is another alternative, and the alternative is not so much Christian education as we know it, but something called spiritual education. So in the UK, at the British Educational Reform Act in 1988, there was the requirement that all education colleges and institutions provide spiritual education. The definition of that is completely open. It's definitely not Christian, but it's moral, it's ethics, it's personal resource and sense of well-being. So it anticipated positive psychology in some ways. So, spiritual education, if you want to look it up for yourself, Oxford Journal of Education, and there's a whole conversation that's running out of that. Details are in the paper. Access that for yourself. So, it's definitely not Christian, but it does offer Christian educators an opportunity to talk about the interior life and what it means to be a spiritual person in the 21st century post-secular age. And I think we can jump on that and make use of that and direct people towards a transformative encounter with Christ through direct experience. The second move that I want to propose and promote is that we Christian educators move our focus from the Christian insider to the non-Christian outsider. Christian education has historically been focused on the insider, you know, the baptised, the chosen, the sanctified, the moral, the ethicised, the good boy and the good girl who comes to the church Sunday school and so forth. But these days, Christian education opportunities, even in Christian schools, are becoming less and less, and even if they are in place, there's less excitement about attending. Because I think there's a misunderstanding of what that all means. So, and I think very often Christian education comes from a Christendom mindset, and I think we can probably do it better. So what I want to propose is that we do something that to this point we've thought almost impossible. Since my interest is on the human person in the divine presence, and as a phenomenological thinker, I'm interested in the experience of being transformed. How do we basically move our accepted pattern of spiritual education from the insider, where knowledge is presumed, to the outsider, where effectively very little knowledge exists? Bible knowledge is down. People are no longer going to churches. In fact, one of the key offences in churches, I don't understand your theological language. Please talk to me at this level rather than this level. In a way, I'm complicating that because I'm trying to recover older language for the lived experience of the spiritual. So the real question here is Christianity willing to share its treasures, its secrets, its mysteries with the outsider? Are we prepared to kind of break bread with those who are very different from us? And are we prepared to use this thing called mystagogical knowledge and practice with the outsider? Is that even possible? Well, I think there's several PhDs in that, so for those of you looking for PhD topics, this might be one particular option. The third move I propose is the move from the God who speaks to the receptor who hears, the human person, the audience who kind of receives things. We think in terms of revelation, where God, like the pitcher, throws something out from himself. He reveals himself. There's an outgoing. The reception idea, all good Catholics understand the notion of reception more so than we Protestants, poor us, is the catcher. So we receive it incoming. And so we have to focus on the human person in the moment of reception. And the genius is not so much... Checking my time, Phil. Okay, you'll call me on it. Okay. I know. So we're not focusing on God as he is in himself, the aseity notion for the good theologians in the room. We're focusing on God as he is found in his human creatures. And that's really, really important. If we can highlight that and draw that out, then we can learn this new skill of biography or theology as biography, and there's something in that. So Daniel Helmeniak talks about the human core of spirituality. Edith Humphrey talks about when the Holy Spirit meets the human spirit, and so forth. There's a fourth move, and I want to finish with this. Instead of focusing on doctrines, we focus on mystical experience. I think that seeing as how our culture has done the three, has undergone the three turns, the turn to interiority, to subjectivity, and to self, and this journey inward, that we have 2,000 years of an amazing theological capacity to reflect on this, and we can effectively follow that turn, those turns, to the God in the soul. Julia Kristeva talks about young adolescents engaged in their spiritual journeys as mystics of the love object, and I think we can explore God in the human person in these kinds of ways. Paul talks about this in his third heaven, although he wasn't wanting to go there too much. But the potential is there to kind of draw this out more than what we do. And I return to that notion of mystagogy. Can we find a way? That's the 10 minutes. I'll finish with a question. Can we find a way to work on our own mystagogy so as Christians, so that we are doing spiritual education, leading people to discover how to be spiritual people in the new spiritual age, but to use this process to point them to Christ. Thank you for your attention.
So you've got 10 minutes to have a think about what...